simplicity and freedom. I find that exhilarating. Two people coming together with no agenda other than the present. And when I want something, I pursue it. But I want to be very clear with you what it is I'm suggesting. He means no ties sex, I realize. Many of the men who have asked me out in the past, I'm sure, wanted me for that rather than love, Isabel's father among them. But few have had the confidence to spell it out so matter-of-factly, and although a part of me feels a little disappointed, I quite like the occasional romantic gesture, another part can't help being intrigued. Which bed did you have in mind? I say. The answer, of course, is the bed at 1 Folgate Street. And if my dealings with Edward Monkford thus far might have led me to believe he'd be an ungenerous or a reticent lover, would a minimalist need to fold up his trousers before sex? Would someone who disdains soft furnishings and patterned cushions also be squeamish about bodily fluids and other signs of passion? I am pleasantly surprised to find the reality is very different. Nor was his reference to an unencumbered relationship a euphemism for one dedicated solely to the man's pleasure. In bed, Edward is considerate, generous, and by no means inclined to brevity. Only when my own senses are blurred by orgasm does he finally permit himself to let go, his hips bucking and locking as he shudders inside me, saying my name out loud over and over, Jane, Jane, Jane. Almost, I think later, like someone trying to imprint it on his mind. Afterward, as we're lying together, I recall the article I was reading earlier. There's a man who's been leaving flowers outside the front door. He said they were for someone called Emma, who died here. It was something to do with the staircase, wasn't it? His hand, which is idly stroking up and down my back, doesn't pause in its movements. That's right. Is he being a nuisance? Hardly. Besides, if he's lost someone he cared about. He's silent a moment. He blames me. He's convinced himself the house was responsible somehow. But the post-mortem showed she'd been drinking, and the shower was on when they found her. She must have been running downstairs with wet feet. I frown. Running seems such an unlikely thing to do in the calm of 1 Folgate Street. Running away from someone, you mean? He shrugs. Or hurrying to meet them at the door. The article said the police made an arrest. It didn't say who. But whoever it was, they had to let him go. Did they? His pale eyes are inscrutable. I don't remember all the details. I was away working on a commission at the time. And he talked about someone, a man, poisoning her mind. Edward glances at his watch and sits up. I'm so sorry, Jane. I completely forgot. I'm due at a site inspection.
Don't you have time for some food? I say, disappointed he's leaving so soon.
He shakes his head. Thank you, but I'm late as it is. I'll call you. He's already reaching for his clothes.
4. I have no time for people who don't strive to better themselves. Agree or disagree?
Then, Emma. The fact is, Brian says belligerently, we can't possibly write a mission statement until we've decided what our values are. He looks around the meeting room as if challenging anyone to disagree. We're in room 7B, a glass-walled box identical to 7A and 7C. Someone has written the purpose of the meeting on a flip pad, company mission statement. There are still torn-off pages from a previous meeting stuck to the glass. One says, 24-hour response, emergency warehouse capability. It looks a lot more exciting than what we're doing. For over a year now, I've been angling to move into marketing. I suspect the fact that I'm here today, though, probably has more to do with being a friend of Amanda's, and therefore of Saul's, than because Brian actually wants me, Saul being quite high up on the financial side. I try to nod energetically whenever Brian looks in my direction. Somehow I thought marketing would be more glamorous than this. Is someone going to act as secretary? Leona asks, looking at me. I take the hint and jump up to stand next to the flip pad, marker pen in hand, the eager new girl. At the top of the page, I write values. Energy, someone suggests. Obediently, I write it down. Positivity, someone else says. Other voices chip in. Caring, dynamism, reliability. Charles says, Emma, you haven't written down dynamism. Dynamism was his suggestion. Isn't it the same as energy? I ask. Brian frowns. I write down dynamism anyway. I think we should ask ourselves, what exactly is the higher purpose of flow? Leona says, looking around self-importantly. What is the unique contribution we at Flow can make to people's lives? There is a long silence. Delivering bottled water, I suggest. I say this because Flow's business is to supply the big bottles of water that slot into office water coolers. Brian frowns again and I resolve to keep my mouth shut. Water's essential. Water is life, Charles says. Write that down, Emma. Meekly I obey. I read somewhere, Leona adds, that we're all mostly water, so water is, quite literally, a big part of us. Hydration, Brian says thoughtfully. Several people nod, including me. The door opens and Saul sticks his head in. Ah, the creative geniuses of marketing hard at work, he says genially. How are you getting on? Brian grunts. Mission statement hell. Saul glances at the flipboard. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? To save people the bother of running a tap and charge them a crazy premium for it. Sod off you, Brian says with a laugh. You're not helping. All right, Emma, Saul says cheerily as he obeys. He winks. I see Leona's head swivel toward me. I bet she didn't know I had friends in management. I write down mostly water and hydration. When the meeting is finally over, apparently Flo's mission and higher purpose is to make more water cooler moments happen every day and everywhere, an insight all present agree is suitably creative and brilliant, I go back to my desk and wait until the office empties for lunch before I dial a number. The Monkford Partnership, a well-bred female voice says. Edward Monkford, please, I say. Silence. The Monkford Partnership doesn't go in for recorded music. Then, Edward here. Mr. Monkford, it's Emma, from 1 Folgate Street. Call me Edward. Edward, I need to ask you something about our contract. I know I should be going through Mark, the agent, about this sort of thing, but I have a feeling he'd only tell Simon. I'm afraid the rules are non-negotiable, Emma, Edward Monkford says sternly. I don't have a problem with the rules, I assure him. Quite the opposite. And I don't want to leave 1 Folgate Street. A pause. Why would you need to? That contract Simon and I signed. What would happen if one of us stopped living there and the other one wanted to stay? Are you and Simon no longer together? I'm sorry to hear that, Emma. It's a theoretical question at the moment. I'm just wondering what the situation would be, that's all. My head is pounding. Just thinking about leaving Simon gives me a strange feeling, like vertigo. Is it the break-in that's done this? Is it talking to Carol? Or is it 1 Folgate Street itself, those powerful empty spaces in which, suddenly, everything seems so much clearer? Edward Monkford considers. Technically, he says, you'd be in breach of contract. But I imagine you could sign a deed of variation to say you take on all the responsibilities yourself. Any competent lawyer could draw one up in 10 minutes. Would you still be able to afford the rent? I don't know, I say truthfully. One Folgate Street might cost a preposterously small amount for somewhere so amazing, but it's still more than I can afford on my tiny salary. Well, I'm sure we can come to some arrangement. That's really kind of you, I say. And now I feel even more disloyal, because Simon, if he were listening to this conversation, would say that I phoned Edward Monkford rather than the agent, because this was precisely the outcome I was hoping for. Simon gets back to 1 Folgate Street about an hour after me. What's all this? He says. I'm cooking, I say, flashing him a smile. Your favourite, beef Wellington. Wow, he says, amazed, looking around the kitchen. Admittedly, it's a bit of a mess, but at least he can see what an effort I've made. How long has this taken? He asks. I did the shopping at lunchtime, and I left work on time to get it all ready, I say proudly. As soon as I'd put the phone down on Edward Monkford, I'd felt terrible. What was I thinking? Simon has tried so hard, and really, I've behaved like a monster these past few weeks. I've decided I'm going to make it up to him, starting tonight. I have wine, too, I tell him. Simon's eyes widen when he sees I'm already a third of the way down the bottle, but he doesn't say anything. Oh, and olives, and crisps, and many other nibbly things, I add. I'll have a shower, he says. By the time he comes down again, showered and changed, the beef is in the oven and I'm a little drunk. He hands me a wrapped-up parcel. I know it isn't till tomorrow, babe, he goes, but I want you to have this now. Happy birthday, Em. I can tell from the shape it's a teapot, but it's only when I get the paper off that I see it's not just any teapot, but a beautiful Art Deco one with a peacock feather design, like something from a 1930s ocean liner. I gasp. It's gorgeous, I say. I found it on Etsy, he says proudly. Do you recognize it? It's the one Audrey Hepburn uses in Breakfast at Tiffany's, your favourite movie. I had it shipped over from an antiques shop in America. You're incredible, I say. I put it down and go and sit in his lap. I love you, I murmur, nibbling his ear. I haven't said it for too long. Neither of us has. I slip a hand between his thighs. What's gotten into you? He says, amused. Nothing, I say. Maybe you need to get into me. Or one bit of you, anyway. I wriggle in his lap and feel him starting to get hard. You've been so patient, I whisper in his ear. I slip down until I'm kneeling between his legs. I've been planning to do this later, after supper, but there's no time like the present and the wine is helping. I pull down his zipper and take out his cock. Looking up, I give him what I hope is a slutty, inviting smile, then slide my lips over the head. For a minute or so, he lets me. But I can feel him getting softer, not harder. I redouble my efforts, but that only makes things worse. When I look up again, his eyes are tightly closed and his fists clenched, as if he's desperately willing himself to get an erection. Mmm, I murmur to encourage him. Mmm. At the sound of my voice, his eyes fly open and he pushes me away. Jesus, Emma, he says. He stands up, pushing his cock back inside his trousers. Jesus, he repeats. What's wrong? I say numbly. He stares down at me. There's a strange expression on his face. Dion Nelson, he says. What about him? How can you do to me what you did to that bastard, he goes. Now it's my turn to stare. Don't be ridiculous, I say. You let him come in your mouth, he says. I flinch as if I've been hit. I didn't let him, I say. He made me. How can you say that? How dare you? My mood's changed again, from euphoria to abject misery. We should eat the beef, I say. Wait, he goes. There's something I've got to tell you. He looks so miserable that I think, this is it. He's breaking up with me. The police came to see me today, he says, about a discrepancy in my evidence. What do you mean, discrepancy? He walks to the window. It's gone dark, but he stares out as if he can see something. After the break-in, he says, I gave the police a statement. I told them I'd been in a pub. I know, I say. The Portland, wasn't it? It turns out it wasn't the Portland, he says. They checked. The Portland doesn't have a late license. So they looked at my credit card records. It seems a lot of work just to check which bar Simon was in. Why? I ask. They said if they hadn't, Nelson's lawyer might claim they weren't doing their jobs. He pauses. I wasn't in a pub that night, Emma. I was in a club. A lap dancing club. So you're telling me, I say slowly, that all the time I was being raped by that monster, you were looking at naked women? It was a group of us, Em. Saul and some of the boys. It wasn't my idea. I didn't even enjoy it. How much did you spend? He looks bewildered. What does that have to do with anything? How much did you spend? I shout. My voice echoes off the stone walls. I hadn't even realized until now that One Folgate Street has an echo. It's like the house is joining in, shouting at him too. He sighs. I don't know. £300. Jesus, I say. The police reckon it's all bound to come out in court, he says. It's just sinking in what this means. Not just that Simon's capable of spending money he doesn't have staring at naked women he can't fuck just because his friends drag him there. Not just that he thinks I'm somehow soiled because of what that man did to me, but what it could mean for the case against Dion Nelson. The defense will say that our relationship is fucked up, that we lie to each other as well as to the police. They're going to say I consented that night, and that was why I didn't report it. I try to make it to the sink, but the sick, all that red wine, the black olives, nibbly things for our special night in, tumbles out of my mouth, a torrent of hot, bitter vomit. Get out, I say, when I finish throwing up. Just get out. Take your things and go. I've been sleepwalking through life, letting this weak, feeble man pretend he loves me. It's time to end it. Go, I repeat. Em, he says pleadingly. Em, listen to yourself. This isn't you. You're only talking like this because of everything that's happened. We love each other. We'll get over it. Don't say something you'll regret tomorrow. I won't regret it tomorrow, I say. I won't ever regret it. We're breaking up, Simon. It hasn't been working for ages. I don't want to be with you anymore, and I finally found the courage to say it.
Now, Jane.
He said what?
He said there's an exhilarating purity to the unencumbered relationship. I mean, I may be paraphrasing slightly, but that was the gist. Mia looks appalled. Is this guy for real? Well, that's the point. He's just so different from anyone else I've ever been with.
You're sure you're not getting Stockholm syndrome or whatever it's called?
Mia looks around at the pale, empty spaces of One Folgate Street. Living here, it must be a bit like being stuck inside his head.
Maybe he's brainwashed you.
I laugh. I think I'd have found Edward interesting even if I didn't live in one of his buildings. And you? What does he see in you, my love, other than the unencumbered fuck or whatever he called it?
I don't know, I sigh.
In any case, I don't suppose there's much chance of finding out now. I tell her how Edward left my bed so abruptly, and she frowns.
It sounds like he's got serious issues, Jay, Maybe avoid this one. Everyone has issues, I say lightly. Even me. Two damaged people don't make a whole. What you need right now is someone nice and solid, someone who'll take care of you. Sadly, I don't think nice and solid is my type. Mia doesn't comment on that. And there's been no contact since? I shake my head. I haven't called him. I don't mention the pointedly casual email I sent the next day, the one that didn't get a response. Well, that is unencumbered. She's silent a moment. And Flower Man, any more from him? No, but Edward said the death was an accident. The poor girl fell down the stairs, apparently. That is, the police did consider foul play, but they couldn't make it stick. Mia stares at me.
These stairs?
Yes.
And foul play? What the hell's that about? Doesn't that freak you out, to know you're living in a crime scene?
Not really, I say. I mean, it's a tragedy, of course. But like I said, probably not a crime scene at all. And lots of houses have had someone die in them.
Not like that. And you living here all alone?
I don't get scared. It's a very calm house. And I have held a dead baby in my arms, I think. The death of a total stranger several years ago is hardly going to bother me.
What was her name?
Mia's pulling out her iPad. Emma Matthews, why?
Aren't you curious?
She taps at the screen.
Oh my God!
What? Silently, she shows me. On her screen is a picture of a woman in her mid-twenties. She's rather pretty, slim and dark-haired. She seems familiar somehow.
And?
I say.
Can't you see it?
Mia demands. I scrutinize the picture again.
See what? Jay, she looks just like you. Or rather, you look just like her.
I suppose it's true, in a way. The young woman and I both have the same unusual colouring, brown hair, blue eyes, and very pale skin. She's thinner than me, younger, and, if I'm honest, better looking. And she uses more makeup, two dramatic splashes of black mascara. But I can definitely see the resemblance.
Not just your face, Mia adds. You see the way she's standing? Good posture. You stand exactly like that.
Do I?
You know you do.
Still think he doesn't have issues?
It could be a coincidence, I say at last. After all, there's no reason to think Edward was even in a relationship with this girl. How many millions of women in the world have brown hair and blue eyes?
Did he know what you looked like before you moved in?
Yes, I admit. There was the interview.
And even before that, the request for 3 photographs. It didn't occur to me at the time, but why would a landlord need to see photographs of his tenants? Mia's eyes widen as something else occurs to her.
And the wife, what was her name?
Mia, no, I say weakly. I'm pretty sure this has gone far enough, but she's already tapping at her screen. Elizabeth Monkford, previously Elizabeth Mankari, she says after a while. Now let's do an image search. She scrolls rapidly through pictures. That can't be her. Wrong nationality.
Gotcha.
She gives a low whistle of surprise.
What is it?
She turns the screen toward me. Not so unencumbered after all, she says quietly. The image is of a dark-haired young woman sitting at some kind of architect's easel, smiling up at the camera. It's quite grainy, but even so I can tell that the woman in the photograph bears a strong resemblance to Emma Matthews. And therefore also, I suppose, to me.
Then, Emma. Telling Simon and the police I was lying about not remembering the rape was bad enough, but telling Carol is almost worse. To my relief, she's very nice about it. "You're not the guilty party in any of this, Emma," she says. "Sometimes we're simply not ready to face up to the truth." To my surprise, though, it isn't Dion Nelson and his horrible threats she homes in on during our session, but Simon. She wants to know how he's taken the breakup, whether he's been in contact since, which of course he has, constantly, though I'm not replying to his messages anymore, and what I'm going to do about it. "So where does this leave you, Emma?" she says at last. "What do you want to happen next?" "I don't know," I say with a shrug. "Well, let me put it this way. Is this separation final?" "Simon thinks not," I admit. "We've broken up before, but he always begs and begs until eventually it just seems easier to let him come back. This time it's different. I've ditched all my old things, all that useless stuff. I think it's given me the strength to get rid of him, too." "But a human relationship is very different from stuff," she says. I look at her sharply. "Do you think I'm doing the wrong thing?" She thinks for a moment. "One of the curious aspects of a traumatic experience like the one you've been through," she says at last, "is how it sometimes results in a softening of your existing boundaries. Sometimes the changes are temporary, but sometimes the person finds they actually quite like this new aspect of their personality, and it becomes a part of them. Whether that's a good thing or not isn't for me to say, Emma. Only you can make that judgment." After my therapy session, I have an appointment with the lawyer who's drawn up the deed of variation on the lease. Edward Monkford was right. I went to a local firm and it turned out they could do one for £50. The only catch, the lawyer I spoke to said, was that Simon might have to sign it too. For another £50, he agreed to look through all the paperwork to see. Today, the same lawyer tells me he's never seen an agreement like it. "Whoever drew this up meant it to be completely watertight," he says. "To be on the safe side, you should really ask Simon to sign the papers as well." I doubt Simon will sign anything that formalizes us splitting up, but I take the documents anyway. As he finds me an envelope, the lawyer says chattily, "I looked the property up in the council archive, by the way. It's rather fascinating." "Oh," I go, "why is that?" "It seems 1 Folgate Street has a somewhat tragic history," he says. "The original house was destroyed by a German bomb during the war. All the occupants were killed, an entire family. There were no surviving relatives, so the council issued a compulsory purchase order to get the remains knocked down. After that, the plot remained derelict until it was bought by this architect chap. His original plans were for a much more conventional building. Some of the neighbours wrote to the council afterward, complaining they'd effectively been duped. Things got quite heated from the look of it. But it went ahead," I say, not really interested in the house's past. "Indeed. And then, to add insult to injury, he applied for permission to bury someone there. 2 people, actually." "Bury someone?" I repeat, puzzled. "Is that even legal?" The lawyer nods. "It's a surprisingly simple process, so long as the Environment Agency raises no objection and there are no local bylaws against it, the council's more or less obliged to grant permission. The only requirement is that the names of the deceased and their location have to be marked on the plans, for obvious reasons. Here they are." He produces a stapled photocopy and unfolds a map from the back. "Final resting place of Mrs. Elizabeth Dominica Monkford and Maximilian Monkford," he reads out loud. He slips it into the envelope alongside the other documents and hands it to me. "There. You can keep that, if you like."
Now, Jane. When Mia's gone, I open my own laptop and type in Elizabeth Mancari meaning to take another look without Mia hovering over my shoulder. But housekeeper doesn't bring up any of the pictures she found. It's true what I said to Mia. In the short time I've lived here, I've never found one Folgate Street a frightening place. But now the silence and the emptiness seem to take on a more sinister hue. Ridiculous, of course, like being scared after hearing a ghost story. But all the same, I select the brightest light setting and go around checking for... what? Not intruders, obviously. But for some reason, the house no longer feels quite so protective. It feels like I'm being watched. I shake the feeling away. Even when I first moved in, I remind myself, it felt like a movie set. I enjoyed the sensation then. All that's happened since is some stupid, abortive sex with Edward Monkford and the discovery that he prefers a certain type of woman. Lying at the bottom of the stairs with her skull smashed in. Without quite meaning to, I go and stare at the spot. Is that a faint outline of a bloodstain long since scrubbed clean? But of course, I don't even know there was any blood. I look up. Above me, at the top of the stairs, I see something. A chink of light that hasn't been there before. I go up the stairs cautiously, my eyes fixed on it. As I get nearer, it takes on the outline of a small door, no more than 5 feet high. A hidden panel in the wall, similar in construction to the concealed cupboards in the bedroom and kitchen. I hadn't even realized it was there. Hello? I call out. There's no reply. I reach out and push the door all the way open. Inside is a deep, tall cupboard full of a cleaner's bits and pieces. Mops, squeegees, a vacuum, a floor polisher, even an extendable ladder. I almost laugh aloud. I should have realized there'd be somewhere like this in One Folgate Street. The cleaner, a middle-aged Japanese lady who speaks almost no English and who resists all my attempts at interaction during her weekly visits, must have left it ajar. The cupboard looks as if it's designed to give access to the house's other services too. One wall is covered with wiring. Computer cables snake off into One Folgate Street's innards through a hatchway in the roof. I pick my way around the cleaning products and push my head up through the hatch. By the light of my phone, I can see a kind of crawl space running the length of the house, its floor thick with more cables. It opens into what looks like a bigger, attic-like space above the bedroom. At the far end, I can just make out some water pipes. It occurs to me I may have just found a solution to something that's been bothering me. I couldn't bring myself to send Isabel's unworn clothes and other things to Oxfam along with my books, but unpacking them and putting them neatly away in One Folgate Street's cupboard seemed wrong too. The suitcase has been sitting in the bedroom ever since I moved in, waiting until I decide what to do. I go and get it, then push it along the crawl space until I reach the attic. It can stay up here, out of the way. The light from my phone isn't very strong, and it's only when I feel something soft under my feet that I look down and see a sleeping bag pushed between two rafters. It has clearly been up here a long time. It's covered with dust and dirt. I lift it up, and something falls out of it. A pair of girlish pajama bottoms, printed in a pattern of tiny apples. I feel around inside the bag, but there's nothing else, except for some balled-up socks right at the bottom, and a business card, very scrunched up. Carol Janssen, accredited psychotherapist. A web address and a phone number. Turning, I see a few other things scattered around. Some empty tins of supermarket tuna, candle stubs, an empty bottle of perfume, a plastic bottle of energy drink. Strange. Strange and inexplicable. I have no way of knowing if the sleeping bag belonged to Emma Matthews. I don't even know how many other tenants there have been in 1 Folgate Street. And if it was Emma's, I'll clearly never know what nameless fear caused her to leave that beautiful, sleek bedroom and sleep up here instead. My phone rings, very loud in the confined space. I pull it out.
Jane, it's Edward,
a familiar voice says.
Then, Emma. I try to get Simon to meet me somewhere neutral, like a pub. But although he says he'll sign the papers, he point-blank refuses to do it anywhere but 1 Folgate Street. I need to come around anyway, he goes. I left some of my things there when I moved out. Reluctantly, I say, all right then. I put the lighting on the brightest setting and pull on some scruffy jeans and my least glamorous old shirt. I'm just tidying the kitchen. It's extraordinary how even with so little, clutter builds up. When I hear a sound behind me, I gasp. Hello, Em, he says. Christ, you gave me a shock, I say furiously. How did you get in? I'm just keeping the key code till I have my stuff, he says. Don't worry, I'll delete it after that. Well, okay, I say reluctantly. I make a mental note to ask Mark, the agent, how to block the code from this end. How have you been? Simon asks. I'm fine, I say. I know I ought to ask how he is too, but I can already see he's not good. His skin has the pale, blotchy look he gets when he's drinking too much, and he's had a terrible haircut. Here's the agreement, I say, handing it to him, and a pen. I've already signed it. Hey, aren't we even going to have a drink together first? I'm like, I don't think that's a good idea, Si. But I realize from the way he smirks, he's already had one. This is all wrong, he says when he's read the document through. It was drawn up by a lawyer, I say. I mean, what we're doing is all wrong. We love each other, Em. We've had our problems, but deep down we do love each other. Please don't be difficult, Simon. Difficult, he goes. That's a bit rich, isn't it? When I'm the one who's been thrown out with nowhere to live. If I didn't know you were going to take me back eventually, I'd be really upset. I'm not going to take you back, I say. Yes, you are. No, I'm not, I say. But I am back, aren't I? Here I am. Just to get your things. Or to come back here where my things are. Simon, you need to go now, I say, starting to get angry. He leans against the counter. Only when we've had a drink and a proper discussion, he announces. For fuck's sake, I shout. Can't you behave like an adult for once? Em, he wheedles. Don't get upset. All I'm saying is I love you and I don't want to lose you. Like this is the way, I snap back. Ah, he says, so there might be a way. I'm torn. If I say there might be a chance of us getting back together at some point in the future, perhaps he'll go without any fuss. The old Emma would have said yes. But the new Emma's stronger than that. No, I say firmly, there is no prospect whatsoever of us being a couple again, Simon. He comes toward me and puts his hands on my shoulders. I can smell the drink on his breath. I love you, Em, he repeats. Don't, I say, struggling. I can't just stop loving you, he says. His eyes are a little crazy. A phone rings. I glance around. My phone is flashing and beeping, shaking itself toward the edge of the counter. Let me go, I say, pushing at his chest. This time he does let me go and I snatch up the phone. Yes? Emma, it's Edward. I just wanted to check that you managed to resolve the contractual issues we spoke about. Edward Monkford's voice is formal and polite. Yes, thanks. Simon's actually here right now, about to sign the paperwork. I can't help adding, at least, I hope he is. There's a short silence. Put him on, will you? Edward says. I watch Simon's face darken as Edward speaks to him. The conversation lasts about a minute, and in all that time Simon barely says a word, just the occasional uh-huh and mm. Here, he says sulkily, handing the phone back to me. Simon's going to sign the papers now, Emma, Edward's voice says, and then he's going to leave. I'm coming around to check that he's really gone, but also because I want to take you to bed. Don't tell Simon that, of course. He hangs up. I look at the phone, gobsmacked. Did I really just hear that? But I know I did. What did he say to you? I ask Simon. I wouldn't have hurt you, he says sadly, not answering my question. I would never hurt you. Not deliberately. I can't help loving you, Em. And I will win you back. You'll see. How long will Edward Monkford be? Do I even have time for a shower? I look at the interior of 1 Folgate Street and realize there are about a dozen rule violations in full view. Stuff on the floor, things on the counters, a copy of the Metro on the stone table, the recycling bin overflowing onto the floor. Not to mention that the bedroom looks like a bomb's hit it, and I never scrubbed away all the wine stains after the party. I do a speedy shower, then hastily tidy up, selecting clothes as I go, a simple skirt and shirt. I hesitate over perfume, but decide that's a bit much. A part of me still thinks Edward might be joking, or that I misheard him. Though I hope I didn't. My phone buzzes again. It's housekeeper, telling me someone's at the door. I press for video and it shows Edward. He's holding flowers and a bottle of wine. So I wasn't mistaken. I press accept to let him in. By the time I get to the stairs, he's already at the bottom, watching me hungrily. You can't hurry down that staircase. It forces you to step carefully, formally, 1 foot at a time. Even before I reach him, I'm dizzy with anticipation. Hello, I say nervously. He reaches out and tucks a stray lock of hair behind my left ear. It's still wet from the shower and it feels cold against my neck. His fingers brush my earlobe and I jump. It's all right, he says quietly. It's all right. His fingers travel under my chin and gently tilt my head up. Emma, he says, I can't stop thinking about you. But if it's too soon, just say so and I'll go away. He undoes the top 2 buttons of my shirt. I'm not wearing a bra. You're shaking, he says. I was raped. I hadn't meant to blurt it out like that. I just want him to understand that this means something to me, that he's special. Instantly, his face clouds. By Simon, he says furiously. No, he'd never... By 1 of the burglars, the ones I told you about. Then this is too soon, he says. He slides his hand out from my shirt and does it up again. I feel like a child being dressed for school. I just wanted you to know. In case... We can still go to bed if you like, I say timidly. No, we can't, he says. Not today. Today, you're coming with me.
5A. You have a choice between saving Michelangelo's statue of David or a starving street child. Which do you choose? The statue or the child?
Now, Jane. Stop here, Edward says to the cab driver. We're in the middle of the city. On every side, dramatic modern constructions of glass and steel tower over us, with the tops of the Shard and the cheese grater just visible above them. Edward sees me glancing up at them as he pays the cabbie. Trophy buildings, he says dismissively. We're going in here. He steers me toward a church, just a small, plain parish church I'd hardly noticed,
tucked away among all these strutting, modernist behemoths. The interior is lovely, quite plain, almost square, but flooded with light from huge windows high in the walls. The walls are the same pale cream as 1 Folgate Street. The sun throws a lattice across the floor from the lead in the clear glass. Apart from the two of us, it's deserted. "This is my favourite building in London," he says softly. "Look." I follow his gaze upward, and my breath is taken away. Over our heads is a vast dome. Its pale void dominates the tiny church, floating on the slimmest of pillars over the entire central section. The altar, or what I assume must be the altar, is directly underneath. A massive, circular slab of stone 5 feet across, positioned in the very centre of the church. "Before the Great Fire of London, there were 2 sorts of churches." He doesn't whisper, I notice. "Dark, gloomy Gothic ones that have been built the same way since England was Catholic, crammed with arches and ornaments and stained glass, and the plain, undecorated meeting houses of the Puritans. After the fire, the men who rebuilt London saw an opportunity to create a new kind of architecture, places where everyone could worship, no matter what their religious affiliation. So they deliberately adopted this stripped-back, uncluttered style. But they knew they had to replace the Gothic gloom with something." He points at the floor, to the lattice of sunlight that makes the stone glow as if lit from within. "Light," he says. "The Enlightenment was literally all about light."
"Who was the architect?"
"Christopher Wren. The tourists flock to St. Paul's, but this is his masterpiece."
"It's beautiful," I say truthfully.
When Edward phoned earlier, there'd been no reference to the suddenness with which he'd left my bed a week ago, no small talk, just, "I'd like to show you some buildings, Jane. Do you want to come?"
"Yes," I'd said without hesitation.
It isn't that I've decided to ignore Mir's warnings completely. But if anything, they've only made me more curious about this man.
And I'm reassured by the fact that he's brought me here today. Why would he do that if he was only attracted to me because of a fleeting physical resemblance to his dead wife?
I have to embrace the parameters he set for us, I've decided, to take each moment as it comes and not burden our relationship with overthinking or expectation.
From St. Stephen's, we go to John Soane's house in Lincoln's Inn Fields. A notice says it's closed to the public today, but Edward rings the bell and greets the curator by name. After some friendly discussion, we're invited to come in and wander as we please. The tiny house is stuffed with artifacts and curiosities, everything from fragments of Greek sculpture to mummified cats. I'm surprised Edward likes it, but he says mildly,
"Just because I build in one particular style doesn't mean I don't appreciate others, Jane. Excellence is what matters. Excellence and originality."
From a chest in the library, he pulls out an architectural drawing of a small neoclassical temple.
"This is particularly good."
"What is it?"
"The mausoleum he built for his dead wife."
I take the drawing and pretend to study it, but actually I'm thinking about that word. Mausoleum. I'm still considering the implications as we get a taxi back to 1 Folgate Street. As we approach, I look at the house with new eyes, making connections with the buildings we've seen. At the door, he holds back.
"Do you want me to come in?"
"Of course."
"I don't want to seem as if I'm taking that part for granted. You do understand, don't you, that this works 2 ways?"
"That's sweet of you. But I really do want you to come in."
Then, Emma. Where are we going? I say as Edward hails a cab. Walbrook, he says, as much to the driver as me. Then, I want to show you some buildings. Despite all my questions, he refuses to say more until we pull up in the middle of the city. We're surrounded by spectacular modern buildings, and I wonder which we're going to. But instead, he steers me toward a church. It seems out of place here in the middle of all these gleaming banks. The interior is nice, if a bit unexciting. There's a big dome overhead with the altar directly underneath, a great slab of rock plonked in the middle of the floor. It makes me think of pagan circles and sacrifices. Before the Great Fire, there were two sorts of churches, he says. Dark Gothic ones and the plain meeting houses where the Puritans worshipped. After the fire, the men who rebuilt London saw an opportunity to create a new hybrid style. But they knew they had to replace all that Gothic gloom with something. He points at the floor, where the big, clear glass windows throw a crisscross of shadow and sunlight. Light, he says. The Enlightenment was literally all about light. While he walks around looking at things, I clamber up onto the altar rock. I fold my legs under me and lean backward, arching my back until my neck touches stone. Then I do a few more poses. The bridge, the upward bow, the lying hero. I did yoga for about 6 months and I've still got all the moves. What are you doing? Edward's voice says. Offering myself for ritual sacrifice. That altarpiece is by Henry Moore, he says disapprovingly. He sourced the stone from the same quarry Michelangelo used. I bet he had sex on it. I think it's time to go, Edward says. I'd hate to be banned from this particular church. We get a taxi to the British Museum. He speaks to someone at the admissions desk, a red rope is lifted, and somehow we're in a part of the museum reserved for academics. An assistant unlocks a cabinet and leaves us to it. Put these on, Edward says, handing me some white cotton gloves and pulling on a pair himself. Then he reaches into the cabinet and takes out a stone object. This is a ritual mask made by the Olmec people, the first civilization in America to build cities. They were wiped out 3,000 years ago. He hands the mask to me. I take it, scared I'll drop it. The eyes are almost alive. It's amazing, I say. In truth, it isn't really my kind of thing, and this isn't my kind of place, any more than the church was, but I'm happy to be here with him. He nods, satisfied. I make it a rule to only ever look at one thing in a museum, he says as we retrace our steps. Any more, and you can't appreciate what you're seeing. So that's why I don't like museums, I say. Just been doing them all wrong. He laughs. By now I'm getting hungry, and we go to a Japanese restaurant he knows. I'll order for us both, he announces. Something simple, like katsu. English people get scared by real Japanese food. Not me, I say. I'll eat anything. He raises his eyebrows. Is that a challenge, Miss Matthews? If you like. He starts me off with some raw sushi, octopus, sea urchin, various kinds of shrimp. I'm well within my comfort zone here, I tell him. Hmm, he says. He speaks to the chef in a fluent torrent of Japanese, clearly letting him in on the joke, and the chef grins at the prospect of serving the little gaijin girl something she won't be able to handle. Soon, a plate is brought over with a pile of white gristle on it. Try some, Edward says. What are they? They're called shirako. Experimentally, I put a couple in my mouth. They burst between my teeth, oozing a briny, creamy goo. Not bad, I say, swallowing, although actually they're pretty gross. They're the fish's sperm sacs, he says. In Japan, they're considered a delicacy. Great! But I think I prefer the human kind. So what's next? The chef's specialty. The waitress brings over a platter containing a whole fish. With a shock, I realize it's still alive. Only just, admittedly. It's lying on its side, feebly raising and lowering its tail, its mouth working as if it's trying to say something. The whole of the topmost side has been cut into thin slices. For a moment, I almost balk. But then I just close my eyes and go for it. The second mouthful, I keep my eyes open. "You're an adventurous eater," he says grudgingly. "Not just eater," I come back at him. "There's something you should know, Emma." He looks serious, so I put down my chopsticks and pay attention. "I don't do conventional relationships," he says, "any more than I do conventional houses." "Okay. So what do you do?" "Human relationships, like human lives, tend to accumulate the unnecessary. Valentine's cards, romantic gestures, special dates, meaningless endearments. What if we strip all that away? There's a kind of purity to a relationship unencumbered by convention, a sense of simplicity and freedom. But it can only work if both parties are very clear about what it is they're doing." "I'll make a mental note not to expect a Valentine card," I say. "And when it's no longer perfect, we'll both move on, with no regrets. Agreed?" "How long will that be?" "Does it matter?" "Not really." "I sometimes think all marriages would be better if divorce was obligatory after a certain time," he muses. "Say, 3 years. People would appreciate each other much more." "Edward," I say, "if I agree to this, are we going to go to bed?" "We don't have to go to bed at all. If bed is difficult for you, I mean." "You don't think I'm soiled goods, do you?" "What do you mean?" "Some men..." My voice trails off, but this needs to be said. I take a shaky breath. "After Simon found out about the rape," I say, "we stopped making love. He couldn't." "My God," Edward says. "But you? You're quite sure it's not too soon?" Impulsively, I reach for his hand under the table and put it under my skirt. He looks surprised, but goes with it. I almost laugh out loud. "Made you look, made you stare, made you feel my underwear." I pull his hand deeper into my crotch, feeling his knuckles slide over my panties. "It's definitely not too soon," I tell him. I keep hold of his wrist, moving against it, rubbing myself on him. He pushes my panties to one side and slides a finger inside me. My knees come up and rattle the table like a medium at a séance. I stare into his eyes. He looks transfixed. "We'd better go," he says. But he doesn't take his hand away.
Now, Jane. After we make love, I'm drowsy and sated. Edward props himself up on one elbow, examining me minutely, his free hand exploring my skin. When he gets to the stretch marks from Isabel, I feel self-conscious and try to roll away. But he stops me. "Don't. You're beautiful, Jane. Every bit of you is beautiful." His questing fingers encounter a scar under my left breast. "What's this?" "Childhood accident. I fell off my bike." He nods, as if this is acceptable, and continues down to my belly button. "Like the mouth of a knotted balloon," he says, spreading it apart. His fingers follow the soft pathway of hair downward. "You don't wax," he observes. "No. Should I? My last... Vittorio liked me this way. There's so little of it," he said. Edward considers. "You should make it symmetrical, at least." Suddenly, this seems hilariously funny. "Are you asking me to declutter my pubes, Edward?" I splutter. He puts his head on one side. "Yes, I suppose I am. What's so amusing?" "Nothing. I will try to minimize my body hair for you." "Thank you." He plants a kiss on my belly like a tiny flag. "I'm going to take a shower." I hear the hiss of water behind the stone partition that separates off the bathroom. From the way the sound changes, I can picture his body moving in and out of the spray, his sleek, hard torso turning this way and that. Idly, I wonder how the sensor recognizes him, whether he has some special privileges still registered on the system, or if there's simply some universal, generic setting for visitors. The water stops. When he hasn't reappeared after several minutes, I sit up. There's a rubbing sound coming from the direction of the bathroom. I follow the noise around the partition. Edward, a white towel wrapped around his waist, is crouched in the shower, polishing the stone walls with a cloth. "This is a hard water area, Jane," he says without looking up. "If you're not careful, you'll get limescale building up on the stone. It's already noticeable. Really, you should dry the shower off every time you use it."
"Edward?"
"What?"
"Isn't that a bit, well, obsessive?"
"No," he says. "It's whatever the opposite of lazy is." He considers. "Meticulous, perhaps."
"Isn't life simply too short to dry showers after you use them?"
"Or perhaps," he says reasonably, "life is simply too short to live it less perfectly than it could be lived." He stands up. "You haven't done an assessment yet, have you?"
"Assessment?"
"With housekeeper. It's currently set to monthly intervals, I think. I'll adjust it so you do one tomorrow." He pauses. "I'm sure you're doing fine, Jane, but having the numbers will help you improve still further."
Next morning, I wake up happy and a little stiff. Edward's already gone. I go downstairs to get a coffee before my shower and find a message from housekeeper on my laptop screen. "Jane, please score the following statements on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is strongly agree and 5 is strongly disagree. 1. I sometimes make mistakes. 2. I am easily disappointed. 3. I become anxious over unimportant things." There are dozens more. I leave them for later, make my coffee and take it upstairs. I step into the shower, waiting for the luxurious cascade of warmth. Nothing happens. I wave my arm, the one with the digital bracelet on. But there's still nothing. A power cut? I try to remember if there's a fuse box in the cleaner's cupboard, but it can't be that. There was power downstairs, or housekeeper wouldn't have been working. Then I realize what it must be. "Damn you, Edward," I say aloud. "I wanted a bloody shower." Sure enough, when I look at housekeeper more closely, I see the words, "Some house facilities have been disabled until the assignment is completed." At least it let me have coffee. I settle down to answer the questions.
Then, Emma. The sex is good. Good, but not spectacular. I get the feeling he's holding back, trying to be a gentleman. When actually a gentleman is the last person I want to share my bed with. I want him to be the selfish alpha male he's so clearly capable of being. Still, there's plenty to work with. Afterward, I sit at the stone table in a robe, watching him cook us a stir fry. He puts on an apron before he starts, a strangely feminine gesture for such a masculine man. But once the ingredients are prepped and he gets going, it's all concentration and precision, fire and energy, tossing the ingredients up in the air and catching them again like a big, sloppy pancake. Within minutes, the meal is ready. I'm ravenous. "Have you always had relationships like this?" I say as we eat. "Like what?" "Whatever this is, unencumbered, semi-detached." "For a long while, yes. It's not that I have anything against conventional relationships, you understand. It's just that my lifestyle doesn't really allow for them. So I made a conscious decision to adjust to shorter ones. I found when you do that, the relationships can actually be better, more intense, a sprint instead of a marathon. You appreciate the other person more, knowing it's not going to last. How long do they usually last? Until one of us decides to call it off, he says without smiling. This only works if both parties want the same thing. And don't think that by unencumbered I mean without commitment or effort. It's just a different sort of commitment, a different sort of effort. Some of the most perfect relationships I've had lasted no more than a week, some several years. The duration really doesn't matter, only the quality. Tell me about one that lasted several years, I say. I never talk about my previous lovers, he says firmly, just as I'll never talk to others about you. Anyway, it's my turn now. How do you organize your spices? My spices? Yes, it's been bothering me ever since I tried to find the cumin just now. They're clearly not arranged alphabetically or by use-by date. Is it by flavor profile? By continent? You're joking, right? He looks at me. You mean they're random? Completely random. Wow, he says. I think he's being ironic, but sometimes with Edward it's hard to be sure. When he leaves, he tells me it has been a wonderful evening.
5B. Now you have a choice.